Now, what we're going to deal with tonight is probably the most essential element in what it's all about. Ultimately, that's what we want to know if we want to know. I don't know whether it was last week that I spoke of it, but a young lady was looking for some guidance in her selecting her college major. I was trying to give her some help. I mentioned a few things, and I said, well, after all, it really depends on what you want out of life. What do you want to do? She said, well, I'd like to make some significant contribution. And I said, why? And she said, don't ask me questions like that. You just get really a little too close to the nitty-gritty. People don't want to hear it. I don't have any trouble with overcrowding in my meetings because, you know, I say a lot of things that are pretty nitty-gritty stuff. And if people want to know the truth, we can help them. If they just want a nice religious facade, they're not going to get much here. We are in the second chapter of Hebrews, a crucial verse here, and they're trying to compare Christ with angels throughout much of this material. Now, angels would represent to us the spirit beings that have interaction with the human race. But now tonight, this section from verse 5 in chapter 2, for not to the angels did he subject the oikoumene, that means the world, the inhabited world, not the world as a cosmos, concerning which we speak. And it was borne witness where one says, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you have visited him? Now, this word visit means care, overseership. It's a noun from the in the same class as the word episkopos. You heard of the Episcopalian Church? Well, episkopos means bishop. Episcopalian Church is ruled by bishops. And a bishop, of course, is an overseer. The essence of the word means someone who looks after things. The point here is sort of parallelism, not so much visiting him in the sense of paying him a call. God didn't just nod to mankind and pay him a visit. The word means in the Hebrew that this quotes, care. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care about him? Now, first of all, that is a fundamental plank in our whole platform. That's what makes this whole thing meaningful. And not only did God make this earth, but he cares. There's interaction. Not like the old deists of an earlier century that thought God created the world, just went off and left it to run by itself. He cares. He's intricately involved in our welfare. And he's quoting here Psalm 8. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? That you care about him, I should say, rather. Now he goes on to say, you have made him for a little time lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor. You have subjected all things under his feet. For a moment, Christ was a sinner. That is, he took upon him the sin of the world. For a moment, he was a man on the earth. And at that moment, in a way, lower than the angels. Only for a small amount of time. He goes on to say, for in that he subjected all things to him, there is not anything left that is not subject to him. Now we see not yet all things subject to him, but we see Jesus, who was for a little time made lower than the angels, in regard to the sufferings of death, crowned with glory and honor, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for all. Now, you have there probably the most crucial statement, the most essential statement of what all of life is about. People want to know what's it all about. Here it is. Here it is. God's creature or creation was itself made only slightly lower than God himself. And that we had in the Garden of Eden. In fact, if I were going to give a title to this tape, which I won't, I don't know if it makes any difference, I would call it Eden West. Now, that might be a rather unique thought to you. You may not have heard anything like that today, at least. And I'll explain that to you. So God made his creatures a little lower than himself. Now, I told you last week, I think, that in the Hebrew text of Psalm 8, which this quotes, this is a quotation from Psalm 8, it says regarding mankind in general that God made him just a little lower than God. So consider the magnificence of the human person with all the marvels of human sensitivity and knowledge and so forth. Just, I'm always amazed at the intricacy of what we are and what we know. May I remind you again, maybe it's repetitious, but can you imagine the capacity to take hundreds of items in this room and in an instant identify them all? You're aware instantly of what they're all about. Your eye catches a picture. You understand what pictures are. Paintings, works of art, all of this just... You distinguish in an instant between a work of art on the wall and an object of art in the china cabinet. But you take it all in an instant. The carpet, the people, the mirrors, the chairs, the rug, the thing going on here tonight, all of it is instantly understood by you. Now bring a gorilla in here and put it in the middle of the room and see if it understands everything in an instant. What's going on here? No, I mean, the gorilla doesn't understand. Yeah, everybody just gets excited and jumps through a hoop because a gorilla has 50 items that it can identify in a lifetime. And here we identify hundreds of items in an instant. We identify them as to what they are, how they're made. We don't really consciously think about it, but subconsciously know here's a painting that is done by oils, you see, and here's a vase, and here's a clock, and here's a rug, and all of that is instantly understood by us. So there is no question about the quality of ourselves as creatures of God. We're very, very like him in so many respects. And he goes on then, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care about him. Now we have a duality here. You have references to Jesus, the Messiah, but you also have references to us. We're linked together. Later on in this chapter, second chapter of Hebrews, we'll see the link. It would behoove him to be made like unto his brethren in all things, you know. And we are his brethren. We are the brothers of Jesus and sisters. So there's a unanimity between what we are and what Jesus was on the earth. We are not yet in the league with Jesus Christ because we've not yet ascended. But we are like Jesus, who tasted death for all of us and went through the ignominy, the humility of the cross, the humiliation of the cross. So he had to go through a period of time when for a bit he was lower than the angels, as a man walking on the earth. Then he became glorified in his death and his subsequent resurrection. As he is, so are we in this world. John, 1 John 4, I think it is. Now we get down to the nitty-gritty of what it's all about. Because it says here that he tasted death for all. We see, now we do not yet see all things under his feet, but we see Jesus on account of the sufferings of death, crowned with glory and honor. The sufferings of death, the pains almost in a way the pains of life. Because this death was a crucifixion of the earthly self. As a result of the fall, the earthly flesh, the earthly self, is dead. It's a gone goose, if I want to say that. And Jesus experienced that. Ultimately, he received the whole weight of the sin of the world upon him. And in that awful moment, he felt separated and cut off from God. Jesus on the cross said, my God, why have you forsaken me? As I think I told you last week, he wasn't just reading from the script. He wasn't saying, well, this is the second paragraph of the scenario. Let's see. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? He wasn't just reading a script. He really believed that, else that whole statement is phony. But in the instant that sin was vicariously attached to him, in that moment, he felt the separation from God. He only felt it in his human flesh. It was not actually so in his spirit, because God could never be separated from God. But in his human flesh, he really felt forsaken. So when you or I today, as a result of our own human inadequacies, feel forsaken, Christ understands that, because that's what he felt. There's no use to say, well, he doesn't understand it because he's God. So I know he felt that. So we join together in company with Jesus, and we are like him. But that entails something here that most people don't like to face. And that is that we must also then, and we are then, crucified with him. Paul said that I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. Paul says, God forbid that I should glory save in the cross of Christ, by whom the world is crucified unto me, and I unto the world. What does all of this mean? Jesus said to the disciples, you must take up your cross daily and follow me. Now what does that mean? What that means is Eden West. That may seem a little esoteric to you. It's the level that you come to in terms of your relationship to Christ, where you understand that the whole process of life on the earth is a disintegrative process and not a building process in the sense of earthly position and status. Now, there is a book out, it was written a long time ago, by Erskine Caldwell called East of Eden. Now, what does that mean? East of Eden means the land of Nod. East of Eden means the place Cain went when he was driven out from the presence of his family because he murdered Abel. East of Eden, the land of Nod, stands for all that evolved out of the secularistic society. Babylon is probably the greatest symbol of that. Ancient Babylon. The works of man, where Cain separated from his spiritual family, is driven out into the to the east, to the land of Nod. Now, that represents the perversion of society, of mankind. The land of Nod represents the ultimate conclusion of godlessness. It was a land of great accomplishment and achievement, but also of murder and sorcery. Immediately in the fourth chapter of Genesis, you have a listing of those who were from the line of Cain, who were great artificers in brass and in metals, and were, you know, they list all the cultural development of these people. At the same time, you have a murder again committed. And this fellow says to his wife, this Lamech says to his wife, I've killed a man. So east of Eden is the land of Nod, which represents all the perversities of a society desolated by the fall. Now Eden, in this statement that I've made, Eden represents the goal of the average Christian today. He wants God to recover Eden for him, you say, or her. To many people, the essence of salvation is they get everything back again. They get restored. They have all the goodies. They get healed and they get financially blessed and everything. And there's a book out called The Christ the Eden Maker. What does it mean? It means that today Christian people want God to recover Eden for them now. But Eden is gone. God is not going to recover Eden on the earth. Now we go west of Eden to the essence of what he is going to do. And that is, he's going to let us share with him in his own handling of the world. Jesus did not come on the earth to have for himself an Eden. The God, instead of bringing him in the lap of luxury, brought him in the crude manger of Bethlehem. He brought him in poverty or relative material devastation or poverty. Relative. He could have brought him in on the throne. He was, after all, heir to the throne of David in the flesh, in the natural. God could have done that in us. And a snap of the fingers restored the throne of David right there in Palestine, or right there in Jerusalem, right in the city of David, which is under the eaves of Jerusalem. The city of David is down in the valley, just below the western wall of Jerusalem. That was the original encampment of David. And then he went on up and took the city, which later became known as Jerusalem. But God could have restored that kingdom to Jesus and had him born a real king of an earthly realm. But Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. Forget that. Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If you're going to follow Jesus as a king, you can't expect a worldly kingdom. You're children of a king, yes, but of a spiritual kingdom. There's a song out, a Christian song. My Father is rich in houses and lands. He holdeth the wealth of the world in his hand. The whole focus of that song is you own it all, you know, so enjoy. You want the house, you want the job, you want a car, what do you want? He'll give it to you, see. That's the implication. The reconstruction of Eden in each private life. Now that's a level of faith that belongs in the sandbox. People just fall apart because the Lord doesn't do this for them or that for them, or why didn't he give me this job, or why didn't he let me get that automobile, or how come he let things fall apart on me, and so forth. Those are the Eden seekers. And that's the next level up from the other, the perversity of East of Eden, or not. But Eden West means that we've left Eden behind. And symbolically, not literally, we have identified with Christ, who was essentially a stranger to the world. He was an alien in the world. He did not have a piece of the action, as they say. Could have had it. Could have had the whole thing. But he didn't have a piece of the action. He was adrift, in a way, as far as this world is concerned. He participated in things, but he was in the world, but not of it. It was all an alien scene to him that he entered for the purpose of shepherding or ministering. He said, I came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. Give my life a ransom for many. Now, the ultimate end of that is this. If we are in this world as Christ was, which is what John says in 1 John 4, as he is, so are we in this world. That means that what we are looking for is not the restoration of Eden, but the functioning of the Spirit in the midst of the world. What is important then, of course, is that we go through the trials and tests and pains of this world in the name of Christ. We accept it, you see. Don't go out and try to crucify yourself. You're going to have trouble getting the nails in your hand. Jesus does not mean when he says, take up your cross and follow me, deny yourself. He doesn't mean be an ascetic. He doesn't mean go out on the hillside and live on grass and nuts, beetle nuts. Not at all. A lot of people take it that way. And they become what we call ascetics, A-S-C-E-T-I-C-S, ascetics. That means without sensitivities. I mean, not paying attention to earthly sensitivity. That's all fleshly. You can go on and live on roots and barks all the rest of your life and grow your hair to your ankles, and still you're not going to get spiritual. It's not what he means. When he says deny the self, he means recognize that the human self has no capacity to save itself. Now, to crucify yourself means to take your place on the cross with Christ and say, the flesh is damned. It's gone. We live in the flesh, but we don't put any weight on it. We don't expect our human flesh to be capable of saving us. And we have to follow through day by day the idiocies of the human flesh and not be swamped by it. In other words, the flesh is going to fail you again and again. But you're not going to get over it as long as you're on the earth. You're not going to get wiser and neater as you get older. Wiser and gooder. As I've said to you before, you can make as big a fool mistake when you're 70 as when you're 17. A lot of them make those mistakes. If you put any stock in the flesh, you're in trouble. You have to live in it. I can't say, you know, go off by yourself and forget about the flesh. You live in the flesh, but you have to understand that God is not going to make the flesh nice. He's not going to make life on this earth nice. Jesus didn't have it nice. He went through the processes of this life and felt its calumnies and oppressions and distresses. Like Hamlet says, you see, to be or not to be, whether it is nobler in a mind to bear the slings and arrows or outrageous fortune. It's a world of outrageous fortune. Just think of it all, the outrageous fortunes around you. People that have it all this day and have nothing tomorrow. People sound and healthy of body today and a physical wreck tomorrow. How many times has it happened that somebody perfectly healthy and all of a sudden a little mole appears and they get it checked by the oncologist and they've got cancer all through them, you know. It's, how often does that happen? Just constantly. A family had that just recently. The son died 3 years ago and the daughter just a couple of weeks ago. One of our people sent the April messenger. I don't even remember what the April messenger sent. But for our encouragement, they said that piece made more sense than all the literature they ever got on the subject. That's good. I don't know which one it was, but the things I'm saying to you now are in connection with that. These are the things that are going to hold you in the midst of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. But they may not make much sense to the high flyers. The people have just, everything is so lovely and they're just so gushy and all, you know. They haven't had the arrow of outrageous fortune yet. And fortune can be so outrageous, it can be so terribly insane, the things that happen to people in an instant. And life gets turned around in an instant. Now, when your life gets turned around and everything is upside down, now you are as Jesus was in this world. You've gone west of Eden, understand? Not east to the perversions. Not Eden itself to recover lovely living. But west to the setting sun, where you see the sun setting on the world, life going out and its fleshly implications, that's Eden West. And that's what you have if you walk with Christ. There is so much in Christendom today, however, of the phony, the facade. Everybody thinks if you are really, really a Christian, everything will be lovely for you. How often have you heard that the mark of true faith is that you get healed? To people universally in the church, that is the ultimate, the summum bonum of all Christian experiences, that you get healed from something. You get your Eden restored. The effects of sin are nullified. After the fall, it was alleged that people should earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. It's almost a satanic effort to reverse what God said in Eden. The present administration is seen to be the gargoyle of the century for making these poor students pay some money. There's always a way to get through, and of course it's all so modest in cost anyway compared. You know, you can go to a state college, university, school, pretty modestly, whatever it is. But it's a con, you know, because, well, it's a con for the Eden makers. Everybody wants Eden restored to the earth. But when you really catch a glimpse of what Jesus meant by denying the self and taking up the cross, what you see there is that the flesh is doomed to failure in the spiritual matters, that is. That God is not out to prove that he can restore Eden. He's out to show that the consequences of Eden are ultimately realized in the total destruction of the human capacity to survive. And that's what we see today in the international picture. The total impossibility of human beings to get along together, to come to grips with issues and decide them on a reasonable basis and say, let's live and let live. Let's turn our energies to economic trade relations and so forth instead of through the military. What a marvelous place it would be, theoretically at least, if the great superpowers would suddenly say, let's forget all of this war material. Let's just put our minds to how we can stabilize the economy of the world. They're not going to do that because the proof of human desolation and the proof of the fall is that the human heart is as desperately selfish and greedy. How often you see it in everyday life, the selfishness, the greed, the people crowding in a line, for example. Just selfishness. At a certain dealership where I get my car worked on, you have to get there early because the people line up. They open at 7:30, and the people are already lined up by then. I usually get there at 6:30 because I have a lot to do and I can sit there and work. So I'm usually first, but there's an apron there. This is just very simple. Here's an apron. It'll take two cars, so the second one comes and parks next. You'd be amazed. Here's a long line. Now people have come, and there's a long line of cars. People will come at the last, see the long line of cars, try to crowd in on the apron and get in first. I mean mature adults, people that are more or less successful relatively, business people and so forth. It's astounding to me, at that age of life, they should be so anxious to crowd in. But you see it. How many ways do you see it every day? The selfishness. That's what destroys most marriages, is selfishness. You could close down 90% of the counseling centers of the country if people just quit being selfish. That's right, because what do the people go to the council for? To get them to support their case for their own selfishness. Please tell my wife to be not so selfish because you've gotten in on my time, you see, or my husband, whatever. If people just quit being selfish, treat each other properly, it'd solve a lot of problems. But that is the normal experience of the world caught in the fall. Now, the point we're really making about all of this is that Jesus comes to us as a spirit orientation, in a spirit orientation. He came into the world, suffered its outrageous fortunes, lived as human beings on the earth, did not try to grasp things for himself, but accepted his role as a spirit being who is an observer. I mean, he helped people too, but I mean, he's an observer. Once you catch that flavor about life, that you are an observer of the tragic comedy that's going on around you, and that ultimately the import of your life is to develop in the spirits. These are the things that are painful. And sometimes pain is a constant process in people's lives. That's why I don't ever press people to be ebullient and joyful. Some people have pain as a constant process. I mean human heartache and suffering. I might quote a few lines here that reflect that. Deep, gutty lines. The glands of grief are weary, have left at last their flooding, and sorrow's symbols yet replaced with anguish unexpressed and unassuaged, coursing in the deep of the breast, in labyrinthine passageways of pain. So that's where grief reaches its ultimate, you see, where the glands of grief have left their flooding. They're weary of crying, of tears. But what is left is an unassuaged, unexpressed grief coursing deep within the heart in labyrinthine passageways of pain. Now that's the point at which the reality of the spirit becomes meaningful. When life has dealt an outrageous blow, and you struggle with that and live with it, and the pain is there always. But now you are as Jesus was in the world, you see. That's where Jesus lived. The Garden of Gethsemane was his ultimate experience. Now you can face the outrageous fortune. You're not. Why? Because you are now in Eden West, west of Eden. You're not demanding the recovery of Eden, but you're rather flowing day by day in the Spirit. Now, practically speaking, what that means is that each day you accept in your life what comes. The bitter, the sweet, you accept it in the name of Christ. You don't have to like it. You can feel hurt if you want to. But you say, this is my part of the humiliation of earth. That's what crucifixion is. Crucifixion was the ultimate ignominy. The death of Christ on the cross was the ultimate expression of human despicable conduct. And Jesus died the ignominious death. But for him, death was not a moment on the cross. Death was all the process of his life on the earth was a dying to the flesh. Now, in a way, this may sound depressing, but what it really does, when you get hold of this, it frees you from being trapped in the Eden process. And you rejoice to join with Christ where he was. Remember, as he is, so are we in this world. We're not here to find our Eden. We're here to walk with Christ in his kind of life and world. If I would go into the average church and talk like that, they'd lynch me. I remember I was speaking at the Hollywood First Press, you know, that grand cathedral near Hollywood and Vine. I was speaking actually to the college age group, which was itself quite an assembly. That's a church within a church. And they had this great banner across the back of the stage, to know Christ and make him known, which sounds lovely on the surface, but I know that gang. And they're very sophisticated in their religious expressions. And what they may mean by that is Jesus is groovy and let's get to know him. So I said to them, I'm not sure you really want to know Jesus that way. I said, there's a dark side, you know. Paul said that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering. If you really ask Christ to make himself known to you, you may feel the blast of the north wind. There is that side because he comes with reality. He's not the daddy of lollipops. He's the father of mercy. And people think, oh, if the Lord loves me, he'll give me this new car or this job or whatever. So then they have the thing called the Fellowship of the Burning Heart. I circulated among the Presbyterians for many years. I remember when I was back in Princeton, I was on the auspicious and august Princeton Evangelistic Fellowship. Somebody called it a gospel team. That's a little too camp. But we went out on the weekends and had our weekend conferences or whatever with the young people. And we started it always on Saturday night with a party or a dance or something. So that was a get-acquainted night. And then we had our program on Sunday, and we went out and usually played football with the boys on Sunday afternoon. That's what all youth leaders do. But, you know, it's such an Edenic kind of thing, and nothing to do with the realities of Christ. I went through all of that stuff. I've been through all of this. So maybe I'm just getting a little bit cynical in my old age. Maybe I have a right to be. Well, I'm going to stop here. Father, we ask you to help us. The understanding of these things, our human minds are limited, but we pray the Spirit will be nourished tonight. In Christ's name, amen.